So today is October 10th, right, 2012. It's the day after my wife and I became parents 25 years ago, a quarter century ago, which is really quite something to sort of reflect on. And I can't think of any way to tie it into my topic, but I will at some point. But I thought I would just share that with you. And today I want to talk about one of the probably, it's on the short list, top 10 most fundamental, maybe top 5, concepts in Buddhism. The fundamental notion in the Pali word of Nibbida, N-I-B-B-I-D-A, which has been variously translated as disgust, revulsion, turning away, or disenchantment. Why is this such a fundamental notion in Buddhism? And for me personally, it's really come to occupy a central place for me in moment-to-moment working with life, working with practicing in life, being with the sweet and being with the bitter in life. This awareness, this attitude, this insight related to Nibbida has been very important for me. And I've delayed really talking about it in here in a far-reaching way. I've mentioned this notion from time to time, but I've never really gone for it. So I thought somehow, you know, a quarter century into parenthood, maybe it's time to go for it anyway. So, as you know, Buddhism starts at home, which is to say, at home in our direct experience. It's interesting that when Buddhism came to the West, it was shrouded in a lot of obscurity and metaphysical language and translations of translations of translations. And it had this quality. I think that was part of its appeal sociologically. But it was like, what? You know, it had that quality to it. And yet, with good translations, especially of the root teachings in Buddhism, the original teachings from the Buddha himself or our closest sense of them, it really comes very directly home to our immediate experience. Sights, sounds, taste, touches, smells, sensations, and thoughts, emotions, hopes, dreams, joys, and sorrows. So when we come really close to our own experience and then we're invited to observe it as it is, what's the case? What do we see? What is it directly known? Very empirically grounded, very down to earth. What do we see? Well, the first thing we see when we look directly at experience is that it's constantly changing. Things appear in awareness, and then they start changing as soon as they appear. Just tracking a sound. It arises, it starts changing, and then it's gone. A sight. Even if you rest your gaze on a certain particular object, you'll start noticing it vibrating fairly quickly within seconds. It's continually changing. Our point of view about things changes, our emotions change. There's this ongoing process of change. We see that. Here we are in the moment, and the moment is continually changing. We also observe our mind doing lots and lots of things with that ongoing streaming. In Buddhism, as you know, there are the four noble or ennobling truths. And the first of these is the ennobling truth of suffering, and it's ennobling to grapple with it and to recognize it and to be made wise by it. So what causes suffering? Not so much the obvious suffering of a brick dropping on our foot or a dear friend passing away or the prospect eventually of our own old age, disease, and death if we're not already there or close to death, but anyway. But rather in terms of suffering, the everyday stuff of stress or contraction or pressure or unfulfilled desires, thwarted expectations, other people being irritating, aggravating, not giving us the respect we want and probably deserve, bumping into us in life, taking the last cookie. Can you believe that? So, what causes that kind of suffering? What do we see? Well, there are different ways to slice the pie, if you will. I want to draw your attention to three ways that suffering is constructed. The first way is that the mind, to survive, driven by the evolved brain, is continually trying to conceptualize or represent or essentialize, reify, the stream of experiencing. It's trying to categorize things, label them, turn them into something static and manageable that it can work with. But that conceptualizing process is like trying to impose a static map on a hurricane, on an incredibly dynamic process of moment-to-moment streaming experiencing. And you can just watch directly the brain's frantic effort to stabilize and label and turn in and thingify what's a fluid and dynamic process. It has an inherent quality of tension in it, effort, strain. You can just watch it continually happening. A second thing is that the brain is continually chasing carrots and avoiding sticks. You know, if there are pleasant experiences, he wants to hold on to them, but they're constantly changing, so there's the frustration of that. Also, we're continually imagining positive experiences, anticipated carrots, and yet they're rarely as good as they're promised, in part because the emotional and motivational systems in the brain that are generating the feeling of the reward, how good it will be to say that to that person, or have Italian food tonight instead of Chinese, or to finally succeed in business in a certain way, it'll feel this good, or to get an A on a test or a paper will be that good. Well, the expected reward, the feeling that we anticipate, is produced by ancient subcortical regions in the brain that evolved with the first mammals 200 million years ago. So they're very primitive in their expectations of how sweet the carrot will be. And if you've probably noticed, typically the anticipated reward is greater than the actual one. And in the same way, the anticipated pain is usually worse. The dreaded experience is usually a lot worse than what we might actually feel. But we live inside this sort of simulated virtual world continually of the anticipated pleasure or the anticipated pain. And so then we chase after the anticipated pleasure, resist the anticipated pain, and we feel tense and pressed and confused in the process, in a word, suffering. Then the third main way that we construct suffering is we self it. We self the stream of consciousness. We turn it into me, myself, and I. For example, various thoughts or sights or sounds or wishes or desires, we claim them as our own. We say, that's mine, right? Or we identify with it as that's mine. Or we think it's about me, right? We make it about me. Or we turn ourselves into the protagonist of the story, this endless kind of stream about myself. Or even most subtly, we take ourselves as the subject of the moment-to-moment stream of experience. We bring an I into it. And yet if we look closely, even though there's an ongoing presumption of an I, we can never locate it. It's never actually there. It's like we look over our shoulder, we can never find an I. We can find awareness, and we can find contents of awareness, and we can find awareness and its contents that are linked to a particular body-mind with a particular history, call that a person, but we can never find an I. Yet when we come from I or me, if we come from I as the subject or we involve a me as the object, as an object in our experience, or if we try to identify with things or possess them, then we bring self into it, which creates taking life personally, and we suffer. So there are these major ways you can see that we engage our experience moment to moment in ways that create tension, stress, contraction, dis-ease, separation, clinging, craving, and suffering. Why do we do it?
We think too much.
Tom says we think too much. You know, again, why do we think too much? What's the aim of thinking? We want to be happy, right? We want to be deeply fulfilled. We want to find lasting, true peace of mind, peace of heart, profound, sublime joy and ease. That's why we do it. Does it work? A traditional metaphor for this is a dog chewing on a dry bone. Dog finds a bone that's been bleached by the sun, sitting out in the sun for a year. And the dog chews it and gnaws on the bone, trying to get some nourishment from it. The Buddha routinely used the language of nourishment or nutriment. So the dog is trying to get something from this bone. And yet the bone is a dry bone. It's a doomed effort. The dog will never find nutriment from this bone. And after a while, the dog just looks at the bone with fill in the blank, revulsion or disgust or disenchantment, and turns away from the bone, realizing that it's not a bad thing to want nutriment from a bone, but it's a doomed effort, because that bone will never give you nutriment. There's no cheese down that tunnel, as it were. And that's where the notion of disenchantment or nibbida comes in. Because through repeated observation, coming down into our own experience of the way it really is, we observe again and again and again that no experience, no phenomenology, no sight, no sound, no taste, no touch, no smell, no thought, no emotion, no desire, is capable of providing lasting fulfillment because it's evanescent and insubstantial, endlessly passing away. And in fact, our efforts to gnaw on our experience moment to moment, the momentary contents of mind, our efforts to gnaw on our experience, to try to find some quality of reward in them, some nutrition, some lasting satisfaction or fulfillment, themselves make us suffer. And the more we suffer, the more we gnaw on the bone to try to find something, some morsel that's delicious, which just makes us suffer more. And yet, over time, because we don't want to suffer, we want to be truly happy, there's a gradual awakening, a gradual insight, a gradual recognition, the school of hard knocks, again and again and again. We make the same mistake. And again, it hurts. It's suffering, subtle or gross. And after a while, ding, duh, you know, Homer Simpson and we, it gradually starts to sink in. This bone will not give me what I truly long for, what my heart really longs for. And incrementally, typically, some and periodically with big jumps, we grow in our sense of nibbida, disenchantment. We gradually wake up from the spell, the fantasy, the programmed delusion, driven by Mother Nature, because it's a great way to keep lizards, rats, and monkeys alive in the wild. You know, to have us chase that bone and to keep thinking again and again and again that this bone will give us nutriment. It'll feed us. It'll feed our soul. And yet, it never has. In the entire history of humankind, it never has and it never will. And then gradually there is a kind of waking up from the spell and a turning away from that which, A, will not truly reward us, and B, is actually profoundly frustrating to chew on every day. So we gradually wake up. And that's the essence of the notion of disenchantment. It's not that we are disgusted by life, which plays into this notion of Buddhism as this very ascetic, anti-pleasure, dour, grim, glum, spiritual practice. It's not that we are revolted by life. In a very narrow sense, occasionally, especially if you're up for the hardcore practice, it can help to accelerate your disenchantment by really looking at other people, including people that are attractive, as bags of pus, or piss or shit, or rotting as corpses eventually. I mean, but it's not because that's how we're supposed to think all the time. That's a means to an end, right? And if it's a little overwhelming, we don't need to do it. But the point is not to sit in revulsion, because what is that? That's aversion. There's no point in having an aversion, a revulsion, a disgust. That's ridiculous. So the dog, when the dog turns away from the bone, the dog is not disgusted by the bone. The dog is disenchanted. It's woken up from the spell that the bone will feed it. And the dog, in some sense, that's healthy, is disgusted with the doomed effort. The dog has had it with the doomed enterprise of trying to get nutrition out of this dry bone. We're not disgusted with the bone. We're disgusted with the quest, the doomed quest. We've had it up to here with the doomed quest. Won't be fooled again. So that's the essence of disenchantment. And then the question becomes, and you can see how it's so central, because the more disenchanted we grow, the less we operate in a wrong relationship to our own experience. There's nothing wrong with experience. What's wrong is our conventional relationship to it, which works great for short-term survival and is lousy for profound fulfillment and peace. We're in a process of changing our relationship to our experience so that we can let it be what it is in this moment while radically letting go of it right now in this moment. And we can also cultivate the factors that lead to happier and more beneficial moments of experience without clinging to the results. It's perfectly all right, and the Buddha lays out lots of practices to do this, to feed, to nutriment, to nurture the factors and to put fuel on factors that lead to happiness and welfare for ourselves and others. It's perfectly fine to encourage those without clinging to the results. Because as soon as we cling to the results, please with me, we're just dogs chewing on a dry bone. There's been often a kind of cultural misunderstanding of Eastern practices, particularly Buddhism, that have said that it's somehow wrong to make efforts to cultivate deep happiness and welfare for ourselves and others, as if that would create striving or clinging. No, it's perfectly fine to do that. And the Buddha names many wholesome practices. Linda went over a number of them, I think, in the last several weeks, including wishing oneself and others well. It's perfectly fine to do that. The art is to do that, is to put those logs on the fire without clinging to the kind of flames you get. Because then that just makes you and others suffer. So progressively what happens in this path is we shift in our relationship to our experience. We become increasingly disenchanted with the conventional habitual pattern of trying to essentialize it or stabilize it or reify it or thingify it. We increasingly become disenchanted with the conventional tendency to chase after carrots and run frantically from sticks. And increasingly, we realize that selfing in relationship to the river of consciousness, the stream of consciousness, the flow of experience, will not wring any more meat out of that dry bone. Never has in the history of humankind, and it never will. And in this process, we become increasingly free. It's a path of happiness. It's a path of the end of suffering. It's funny that through disenchantment, we don't move into this grim, dour, glum stance, but in fact, we stop banging on our foot with a dry bone. What helps us do this is insight again and again and again, mindfulness again and again and again. We see again and again and again that orienting to the stream of consciousness in a way that involves grasping, clinging, selfing, it's like a dog trying to get meat out of a dry bone. To finish up here and then see what you think about this, because disenchantment is not the conventional way, it's not Mother Nature's plan. Mother Nature wants us to be caught up in the spell. One thing that really helps is to have an ongoing kind of inner reminder about not being fooled again, which usually manifests about 2 to 10 seconds into the stream. And then you go, whoop, and then whoop. You know, we come out, we pull up out of it. But to have that kind of ongoing, regenerated many times a day recognition that relating to our experience, like a dog chewing on a dry bone, is not good for us or others. The other thing that really helps is to open to how good it feels to not chase that bone, to not gnaw that bone. It feels so free, just to kind of fall back, as it were, into the rising fountain of experience, moment after moment after moment, without clinging and without illusions, without enchantments. It feels incredibly free and fun and buoyed and amazed, you know? It's amazing what experience consists of, moment to moment. And in that, what starts happening increasingly is as we chew less and less and less on the conditioned contents of our experience as they appear, the sights, the sounds, the tastes, the touches, the smells, the thoughts, as we gnaw on that which is conditioned and we increasingly relax, soften, open, have love. Love allows us to do this. It's deeply important as a nutriment, a log on the fire that lets us soften, open, and cease gnawing. As we do that, we start having more and more of an intuition as we fall back into the fountain, and it lifts us, of what is just prior to conditioned phenomena manifesting before they pass away. Just prior. In other words, that which is unconditioned, that which does not change, that which does not that which is not born and that which is does not pass away. And that's where, to read you and finish up on my talk and then see what you think, to read you a quote from the Buddha. And I'm speaking here about that intuited sense of something that's profoundly beyond language, you know. It's beyond concept. As soon as it's conceptualized, we're making the first cause of suffering that I talked about, conceptualizing, representing, categorizing, reifying, essentializing things. And this, by definition, cannot be conceptualized because it's unconditioned. It cannot be represented at all. But yet, because it's always the nature of things in their underlying existence, we have an intuition of this incondition. Call it the ground. Some people might relate to it in a sense that's very divine. Other people would not relate to that ground, do not relate to that ground in that way. And yet there's a sense of something of a profound mystery, something sacred, something transcendental. And that's where we find our true home increasingly. We give up increasingly trying to make our home out of bones. And instead, as the Buddha says, make our home in that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the noble ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights. What do you make of all this? Yeah, I'll start with a very concrete and probably common example. If you ever had the experience that you were reaching for a cup that you thought was full of water, and in fact it was only about half full or a quarter full, and you reached for it and you lifted it up firmly, expecting that the thing would weigh half a pound, but it only weighed about a quarter of a pound or a tenth of a pound, and the water kind of sloshed around, or some variation on that idea. Or you expected there to be one more step at the bottom of the stairs and there was no step and you lurched, right? Or you expected that you were at the bottom but there was a step, you know, and then you really lurched, right? We've all had kind of that. Well, continually, both at a sensory motor level and in a more complex level, the brain is continually generating a map of expectation. It's continually generating expectations. The brain, in a sense, is an anticipation machine. What?
That can't be good.
Well, it's phenomenal for helping critters survive. You know, like our cat. We have, you know, I've known cats a lot in my life. I've been friends with, I think, or I won't use the possessive. I don't think you possess a cat, especially. Maybe they possess you, but anyway, I won't say that I've had a cat, but I've been friends with cats, and. Our cat is, our sounds possessive. Anyway, the cat we live with, Tsunami, is very, very smart. He's a very, very smart cat. Except, he's getting older, and there's a cat next door that's a wonderful cat, which is about 50% larger than Tsunami and about half his age. And so they're very territorial. They're both male cats, and even if spayed, if you will. And so what was happening is they were getting into fights continually. So we, with our really wonderful neighbors, developed a system where we have their day, our day. So we have, like, today is an in day for Tsunami. It's an out day for their cat. Tomorrow will be an out day for Tsunami. Now just think about that. For a cat to try to understand, but, I'm an outdoor cat, and suddenly I got to be in, in, and then suddenly now I'm out, and then I'm in, and like, what? And yeah, and so he has gradually kind of sort of figured out that there are two kinds of days in his life. One kind is incredibly boring, stuck inside the house, looking out the window. You know, that's all he can do. If he sees the other cat going by, bristles and hisses. Or then there are other days that are great days. He's outside. He smells his other cat, asshole cat next door, pees on his territory. Yeah, see ya, buddy. You know, but and it's great. He's got a free ride. But then the next day, he's stuck inside. Like, that's really hard for him to figure out. Okay, he barely can kind of sort it. He's actually at peace now, seemingly. He's kind of sort of adapted to it, I think. But just that basic idea, yesterday and tomorrow, that's an incredible stretch for the smartest cat I've known. Now just think how often we as humans play with what's called mental time travel, where we reflect on the past, or we imagine the future. And we do that continually. We imagine, even in conversation, you know, the thought stream comes up, I could language it this way, and we go, that's a bit of a charged word. Last time I said that to my fill-in-the-blank spouse, daughter, son, friend, whoa, I pulled back a bleeding stump. Better not do that. So we're constantly doing that. You know, how should I adjust in terms of traffic? Should I speed up or slow down? Where's the flow of this meeting going? You know, when should I introduce this point? Right? We continually do that. It's a very natural process, and in the brain, as the brain tripled in volume in the last 3 million years, a lot of the volume, particularly in the midline, the so-called default network, is very involved in running simulations. What do people do in the MRIs when they're not doing anything at all, and they're just kind of daydreaming or thinking about their day or imagining, gee, is the voice on tonight, or is it going to be the good wife, or... You know, that phrase is a kind of a curious phrase, the good wife, you know, wives, 50s, suddenly we're lost, you know, we're lost in the simulator. And that's a fantastic way to plan hunts or to learn lessons or to imagine behaviors and deepen their neural traces so we learn them better. You know, it's a fantastic evolutionary development. But the problem is, to the extent that we live there, one, it takes us out of the moment. Two, it's where lots and lots of carrot chasing and stick avoiding happen, and where, since neurons that fire together wire together, a lot of bad habits get wired into the brain. I become a lot more leery of what I'm running in my simulator since learning about the brain, and have attempted to much more try to stay in the present. And if I am anticipating or planning something, to be thoughtful and careful about it, to be kind of disenchanted. Another word for that, moving to a wrap, is to not be so fascinated. We tend to be very fascinated with our inner process, right? You know, it's so interesting. And there's a place for self-awareness and investigation, but fascination,
that's kind of what I meant when I said we think too much.
Yeah, I think we think too much. Tom said, fascination is we think too much. That's what he meant by that. Yeah.
So, when you talk about the dog letting go of the bond, and then finally there's disenchantment, and then after disenchantment, we become free. But wasn't the dog sad to let go of that bond? And
no.
And would the dog keep thinking, oh, maybe, I mean...
If I just chewed it the right way. If I just chewed it the right way, or I just got the right bone, right? The right room.
I miss that bone. Or, you know, gosh, even though it didn't give me nourishment, I still miss it. Or the quest, I still miss the quest, or, you know, the, I mean, I'm just thinking of my human.
Yeah. Well, I think you're naming something kind of interesting, you know, the idea of we miss the quest, you know? I think that really is true. But just think about, you know, I mean, we're the Buddha brought it down, and this is where it starts getting very free and very radical, where you're very peacefully present with your own experience, like in meditation, say, or moments in meditation, and it's rolling through, it's okay, whatever it is, and there's no chewing on it, right? That's a taste of freedom right there. At I'll call that the micro level, and by I don't mean my micro trivial, I mean more like micro the essence. The more granular this can get, you know, the freer we are with sights, the freer we are with sounds, the more we see them as constructed, arbitrary, conditioned, and incapable. A little detail here, you routinely see that experience is described as unsatisfactory in Buddhism, or unsatisfying. It's a little bit of a trick of the English language. What it really means is that experience, which is to say phenomenology, the contents of mind, just sights, sounds, bring it down to earth, the sensation in your knees right now, the taste of a cookie, the taste itself, the experience itself, is incapable of being fundamentally satisfying. So it's not that it's unsatisfactory or dissatisfying, it's just that it's incapable of being satisfying in a fundamental way, in part because it's gone as soon as it starts being satisfying. And you can watch it in your mind. You're tasting the chocolate right there. And you want more of it, but it's disappearing as you want more of it. And the wanting more of it while it's disappearing is dukkha, the first noble truth right there. It's that immediate. It's that granular. It's that immediate. So the more that you can practice with this, closer and closer to the immediacy of this moment, then the freer we get, down to the fine print. That said, where disenchantment is evident in typically is in much grosser ways. You know, we get all excited about doing something. I get this routinely. I think, oh, I'm going to do this project. It's going to be so great. I'm going to do the Compassionate Brain series. You know, I'm going to get to talk to the all-stars. I'm going to have lots and lots of people listen. And then when I actually have the experience, it's nice. You know what I mean? And I'm not putting it down. But, you know, but it's kind of, yeah, nice. Most of life is meh. You know, not like we all should be bummed out and jump off a bridge, but if you really look closely, it's like, or you work really hard to go out on a date with that person, or you work incredibly hard to lose those 10 pounds. Has anyone, don't raise your hands. I'll just do a thought experiment. Are any people in this room tried to lose a little weight? And then when you lost that weight, were the rewards as billed, as anticipated? You know, it was nice, but did it really bring you true love? Did it really, you know, put you in the top of the heap socially? Or people making a lot of money, people working hard to make money, or get a promotion, you know, and or to prove a point in an argument, or to win, or to vent of an emotion. And then increasingly you realize, wow, that's not where true happiness is deeply. That's not where deep happiness is. I see hands shooting up, of course, as we're running out of time, as usual. But that, I invite you to really look into that for yourself. And the point of it, to go to your point, is not to be grim, but to be free of this, like, oh my God, this burdensome, doomed, futile effort to try to get marrow from the dry bone. Y'all look really unhappy. Not always. Y'all look pretty bummed out. I don't know. I'm like, thank God. Sick and tired of chewing on bones. That's the other thing. You feel it. You feel it in yourself. Like, I'll just leave you on this one, maybe. I'm going to leave you on this one so I end on time for once, and I'll happily talk to you right afterward. But it's this. Like, in your heart, do you ever get the feeling like you're just sick and tired? I'm going to be really, really blunt here. You're just kind of sick and tired of the whole bullshit undertaking. It's not that you want to jump off a bridge, but there's some fundamental process of manufacturing myself in interaction with you, or getting this result, or thinking that it's going to be like this. And after a while, you just get tired of it, kind of tired with your own mind stream. You just, that is the useful, good place of the dog. He's just like, tired of that. That's nibbida. That's disenchantment. How about we sit with this for about half a minute? As the bell rings here, letting the three waves of sound move through awareness without seeking anything from them, without chewing on them for anything.